TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Vandana Shiva, Genetically Engineered Food and the Militarization of Agriculture. Dr. Vandana Shiva trained in physics with a dissertation on quantum theory, born in Dehradun, India, the daughter of a forest conservator and a farmer, is one of the great ecologists of our time. She has written over 20 books, including Water Wars, Pollution, Profits, and Privatization, Biopiracy, the Plunder of Nature and Knowledge, Monocultures of the Mind, and The Violence of the Green Revolution. Vandana Shiva has challenged for decades GMO corporations such as Monsanto, large hydro dam builders, and governments, including her own, on issues of agriculture, genetic engineering, deforestation, abuses of science and technology, and globalization. She has started a movement from her birthplace in the foothills of the Himalayas and is dedicating her life and creative energy and huge knowledge to what may seem the most humble of tasks, the protection of the seed and the practice of non-chemical, non-pesticide, and absolutely non-genetically modified agriculture. Navdanya means nine crops that represent India's collective source of food. She founded the organization Navdanya in 1991, and it has grown into a national movement. The main aim of the Navdanya Biodiversity Conservation Program is to support local farmers, rescue and conserve crops and plants that are being pushed to extinction, and make them available through direct distribution. They are fighting the theft of people's knowledge by biopiracy and protect food rights in the face of globalization. Vandana Shiva has been the keynote speaker at all Heirloom Seed Expo events since the beginning in 2011. The annual expo is a focus for seed collectors, farmers, gardeners, and their supporters. They are building an international movement to rescue the precious heritage of seeds from being placed in private ownership and then engineered and patented. Often they are purposefully destroyed by an ever smaller number of multinational seed corporations. And they counter the global expansion of laws that make saving and replanting seeds illegal. On her way from India via the San Francisco airport to the Heirloom Seed Expo in Santa Rosa in mid-September 2013, Vandana Shiva stopped at IONS to meet with a group of friends. She gave one of her cherished, more personal talks that you will hear in a moment. IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences, was founded in 1973 by Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell. He was deeply moved by seeing the Earth from space. Shiva had been invited by Sergio Lube, the founder in 1999 of the first social network on the Internet. Friendly Favors is built on the exchange of gifts among its members. Now I'm taking you to the small half-round theater space at IONS, with a view over the rolling hills and oak savanna of Northern California. Vandana Shiva had been given 2 hours of rest before her keynote speech at the expo, and she decided to spend them with us. Vandana Shiva.
Thank you, Sergio, and it's nice to stop at this beautiful place. I'm so glad some places on Earth are being protected like this. That's what we've tried to do in Dehradun, on our little farm. And I've left a group of 55 people who are there to learn the A to Z of organic farming. We've always offered courses for farmers. That's why we exist. But increasingly, I have one employee of Walmart. He says within a year he wants to leave Walmart and go back to his village and live the real life. No matter where you started, you know, you could start in health, or you could start in spirituality, or you could start in protection of wilderness, we are all realizing that the place where we have to do this work is how we grow our food. And that's because the highest destruction is being done by a food system that's not even feeding people. That's the irony of it. Claims to feed people, but it's not feeding people. I just looked at the data. 10% of the GMO corn and soya goes to feed people. And that against their will, because they're eating it only because there isn't labeling to say, I won't eat this either. If there was labeling, it would be 0%. My own work was really in quantum theory. That's where I trained, that's where I worked. And if I'm doing work on agriculture for the last 30 years, it's because of the violence related to industrial chemical farming. And the wake-up call for me came in 1984. There were three things that happened that year. June of that year, I remember the date, it was 4th of June. The shrine of the Sikhs, the Golden Temple, was invaded by the army because we had an extremism growing in Punjab. And the Bin Laden of Punjab of that time, his name was Bhindarwale, was hiding in the Golden Temple. Indira Gandhi had promoted Bhindarwale just like the CIA had promoted Bin Laden. Because they always think, catch an extreme person, destabilize the society, and through that you get your control. But you never got control. Because you become victim to your own use of violence and extremism in a way to blackmail society. And then you get, it comes back on you. So by November of that year, Indira Gandhi had been assassinated by the Sikhs. And it's not over yet because they keep squashing the justice issue related to the killings of Punjab. I always say it was 6/9/11, 30,000 killed. Sonia Gandhi is in New York for treatment for cancer. She's got a summons from a New York court because there are enough Sikhs in this country who are continuing that fight for justice. So that was the first. A little later, I heard about a very severe drought in a part of southern India, Karnataka. There was this news item of this many animals die, like the kind of news you had this year on the drought of the USA and the Midwest. You know, I did the first thing you normally do in such a situation. Okay, how much did the rainfall decrease? Because normally a drought is, rainfall is less. The rainfall was just the same, it's 1,200 millimeters. So I said, there's something very strange. The rainfall hasn't come down, but animals are dying and people are migrating. So I sent my team down. I said, go find out. Turned out they had changed the crops. They had gone from the traditional varieties of sorghum, which are very tall. They're tall like Bill and Sergio. Even taller sometimes. But the problem with those tall varieties is which are the indigenous varieties. When you apply chemicals, they rebel. And they rebel through what's called lodging. So traditional varieties can't promote the use of chemicals. So they'd introduced these short varieties, the dwarf varieties. And the dwarf varieties are about that high with a very tough stalk, which doesn't get eaten by animals, doesn't go back to the soil. An old man said, bring me one seed of the old sorghum and it will drive away the drought. Because the old sorghum gave back organic matter to the soil. That held the moisture. You can get the normal rain, but if there's nothing to hold the moisture, it's all going to run away. And you will have drought. So I start to realize there's meteorological drought, which is related to how much rain falls. But there's soil drought, related to how much your soil can hold. And we've kind of underestimated the role of soil, both in soil fertility as well as in water conservation. The biggest reservoir is not these dams of concrete. The biggest reservoir is our soils. And as climate extremes and climate change have increased, we've been doing studies with soil and their resilience. You know, 10, 20, 30% more water holding capacity. 2009, we had very, very severe drought. And when I traveled to the communities in the drought areas, farmers who had come in to Navdanya for training and were doing organic, they had a crop in spite of the rainfall failure. And those who were waiting for the Green Revolution varieties to get enough rain had zero output. So I realized seed is important. By 2nd of December 1984, there must have been some reason why Orwell chose that as the date for his novel, 1984. 2nd of December, Union Carbide's plant in Bhopal leaked, its pesticide plant. And this gas, because it was winter and the inversion layer was very low, and the gas just moved through the town and killed people, 3,000 immediately in that one night. 3,000. Since then, 30,000 dead. Hundreds of thousands crippled. Because this gas called methyl isocyanate, it immediately affects the eyes and the lungs. Most of the poor people in the slums work as daily wage laborers, and the women work in stitching. So they couldn't stitch anymore because they couldn't see. And the lungs had gone, so they couldn't, you know, normal thing is you take. My favorite alternative to Walmart is, you know, when they say, but what's the alternative to Walmart? I say, the push cart. Put some staff. And when they ask me, what's your model of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology and Ecology? Such a heavy name that when I was debating the World Bank on forestry issues in the mid-80s, and they had planted a Times article talking about the critique being promoted by this rich woman who has a foundation. Yeah, the foundation was in my mother's cow shed. And when people would ask me, you know, what's your model? I'd say, my model is very simple, a push cart. If people are having problems with a dam, I do research on dams. If there's a problem with mining, I do research on mining. And then, of course, I had to start doing research on agriculture because of all these events of 84. Last year, I was there for the anniversary, and I was in a hall full of parents with children, crippled children. Because children till today are being born with deformities. So, in a way, the Bhopal disaster isn't over. And every time I hear these noises of warmongering over 200 children, and we don't know who really used the chemical weapons in Syria, nobody really knows. And whoever killed those children, it's unforgivable. 30,000 in Bhopal killed? That was chemical warfare. So I decided to do a study at the end of 1984. I said, something's so wrong with agriculture. Why is it so violent? And that's part of the problem, that we took food and agriculture so much for granted. You know? Everything else was important, but not that. And we all turned our backs. I turned my back also. So I spent a whole year. Fortunately, I had a United Nations University associateship that time, and I was working on conflicts over resources. And I said to them, I think there's a conflict over resources going on here, and I want to study it. So I spent a year looking at what was happening in Punjab. Punjab was the land where the Green Revolution was first introduced. And it was called the Green Revolution because red was a problem. That time. Red is not a problem. Red is not a problem now because red has become the biggest part of capitalism. It's fascinating, isn't it, how communism is carrying capitalism after capitalism died. So they had to choose a different color, and plants are green, so they called it green. The Nobel Prize was given to it. Nobel Peace Prize was given to it. On grounds that those chemicals will create prosperity and prosperity will create peace. And this is so central to the mythology of the industrial food system that no matter how much evidence we get countering it, it's not allowed to be introduced. So I remember years ago I was traveling with my son to get him to his school. He was joining Rishi Valley, a school started by Krishnamurti, the first school started by Krishnamurti, who also started a school near Santa Barbara in Ojai. And the land there, the landscape is like this, and for centuries, farmers have been conserving water, and it's full of tanks and lakes, the landscape of South India. So my son just commented and said, oh, people here must be starving. He was hardly 7 years old. He said, people here must be starving. I said, why do you say that? He said, because our textbook says, wherever there aren't big dams and there isn't the Green Revolution, people starve. And it's not that it's over. I go to universities and ask, what are you learning about the Green Revolution? They're learning the same thing. Because of this long debate I've had with Monsanto, and I'll come back to that debate, but the interesting thing is every 2 years they find a PR spin master who is zipped around the world to continue the propaganda in spite of the evidence. And they found a young guy from Oxford who claims to be the founder of the anti-GM movement. And I always say, you must have been in the crib. Because the movement started 30 years ago, and you're barely 30. Anyway, he came to talk about Borlaug. Norman Borlaug was the man who is associated with the Green Revolution. And he gave a speech, and he talked about Borlaug descending to the earth as a god to save humanity from hunger. Now, part of it is Borlaug himself talked that language. Borlaug talked about the seeds as miracle seeds. I would call them deficient seeds because you've taken the store away. The straw is what keeps the food system going. The straw is what goes back to the soil. If you're not giving back to the soil, then for a while you can use chemical fertilizers, but at the end of it, you've got dead soils. He talked about the 12 people he trained to spread this package of chemicals and seeds. He called them his wheat apostles.
12.
Yeah, he picked 12. He picked 12. I'm just waiting to get the time, and I need to respond to some of this because they're attacking our parliament, they're attacking our courts, they're attacking everyone with this kind of rhetoric. So we had the Green Revolution, it failed, the farmers were mad, they took to the guns. And the story of Punjab is the story that I studied. Why were the farmers angry? They were supposed to have been prosperous. Well, they weren't prosperous. You can give subsidies for 2 years and 3 years, which is what happened with the Green Revolution. The World Bank said, the US pushed it, the World Bank said, we'll give you the money for the chemicals. The US said, we won't give you wheat, you have to take the fertilizers and introduce chemicals. And 3 years, 4 years later, they withdrew the subsidy because that's always the case. Let it come for free. It's in a way the economics of the drug pusher. I don't know a single place where the first dose is sold at the price at which it'll be sold later. It's normally just given for free. Try it. Yeah? Once you get addicted, then you pay the full price. And that's what happened with the chemicals and the seeds. Hybrid seeds are first given for free. And because farmers have so many centuries of experience that you grow a crop, you'll get a seed. They don't know a hybrid seed won't give them a seed. No one tells them that. So within a year, they can have a seed famine. Genetic engineering was introduced with only one aim: to be able to get patents on seed in order to collect royalties. This was the project that started in the mid-70s. Actually, the hybrid corn started last century, but Monsanto wasn't in the seed business then. Monsanto was only chemicals, Agent Orange, everything else. They got into the seed business after the finding out of the recombinant DNA techniques, where you could chop DNA from one organism and shoot it into another. And there was a very interesting conference in California in 72 called the Asil-Omar Convention, where the scientists said, we don't know the consequences. But then the companies jumped in, partnered with some of the scientists, and the moratorium that the scientists wanted got undercut by taking science to Wall Street. Then it became an issue of selling on Wall Street. And you didn't have to have a product to deliver. You sold a promise. So the first GMO was a total failure. There were no movements in California when a tomato called the Flavor Saver tomato was introduced. How many of you remember the Flavor Saver? Yeah? It failed because tomatoes that don't rot are tomatoes that don't cook. I mean, I miss a lot with Indian cooking when the older tomatoes, you chop them up. And the normal seasoning is, you know, you put a little oil, then you put a little jeera, the cumin, then you put some onions, and then you put the tomato. And at the end of it, this thing is nice, juicy gravy. But the tomatoes bread today look like salmon after the cooking. They don't dissolve. Because they're meant to sit on Walmart trucks for days and days and days. So breeding has gone way out of the cycle of regeneration and reproduction. And the first interruption has been, A, biologically make it impossible to use a harvest to plant the next crop. And the second has been the patent law, make it illegal. You know, because in a way, compared to gardeners and farmers for centuries, who've done such brilliant breeding and given us so much diversity, actually genetic engineering is very crude technology. In the 80s, when I started the debates with people who were promoting biotechnology, I remember one of the very early debates was with David Hopper, who was then the vice president of World Bank, but before that had been the man in Rockefeller Foundation who pushed the Green Revolution. And he is saying, you know, at 84, I'd done my study on the Green Revolution Punjab, and that's what I was talking about. And he turns around and says, there's nothing to worry, Dr. Shiva. Those toxic soils will be growing GMOs. Genetic engineering will allow us to grow food on the moon in the Sahara Desert and toxic dumps. All they're able to do is two traits, herbicide resistance and BT toxins. They don't know enough about how plants work. They're working in ignorance. And there's a very interesting narrative they have. Because we're working at the genetic level, we are more accurate. Now, because they're shooting genes, they are even more inaccurate. Because when a whole plant is bred with a whole plant, the harmony of the genome works itself out. And they make it look like the whole genome functioning is somehow inaccurate. And when they take a gene and shoot it into a cell in a petri dish, somehow they're being more accurate. They don't even know if that shooting is working, so they have to add an antibiotic resistance marker. So after the shooting, they pour the antibiotic on the petri dish, and the cells that did not absorb the gene die. Then they take the ones that didn't die and then grow them out. But they have to add another gene for a promoter because there's a tendency of silencing. You know, those genes don't belong to the plant. The plant on its own wants to crush them. So they have to add a virulent promoter. And if you remember when the avian flu spread, the H1N1 virus spread, they found virus components in it from human genes, a human virus, chicken virus, and a pig virus. And that mixing is happening because we are crossing species boundaries more and more with genetic engineering. And once it's crossed for the manipulation, then disease can also cross those species boundaries. So I got a letter from China at the time of the SARS epidemic. You remember the SARS epidemic? And the scientist wrote and said, because that those days very few of us were writing on genetic engineering, and he says, my assumption is that all the genetically modified soya that's being brought into this country to feed animals, the virus in the soya has interacted with the virus in the guts of the animals, created a supervirus. And then that supervirus has jumped from animals to humans. All absolutely plausible. It happens. When the mad cow disease happened in the UK, the minister went on and said, oh, it's just in the cows, it's just in the cows, it won't jump the species boundary. And there were scientists saying, no, it will. And then the 12 people died with the BSE. That's when they woke up to what was really happening to the animal industry. where they were taking dead cows, grinding them up, and feeding them to the cows. And one of my nightmares, one of the reasons I keep traveling like this and exhausting myself and just keep going, is because my nightmare is these guys are incompetent in bringing us food. And if we don't change track, that's the kind of direction into which they'll push us. And the reason they're so afraid of labeling is because they won't be able to do that work if labeling becomes a recognized right and gets institutionalized in society with GMOs. Because they really want a food system where they can put anything into anything. And for them, the idea is, if they don't have control, their scarcity. Now, a seed, giving rise to seed, is an economy of abundance. But if you want royalties, then a seed giving rise to seed, in their perspective, is stealing.
That was the first part of a talk by India's most famous ecologist. Vandana Shiva is the author of many books. The violence of the Green Revolution has become a basic challenge to the dominant paradigm of non-sustainable industrial agriculture. She's a founding board member of the International Forum on Globalization and received the Right Livelihood Award in 1993. Her organization, Navdanya, has grown from a three-acre plot in her hometown, Dehradun, to include a learning center, the School of the Seed and Earth University, and an organic farm in Doon Valley, North India. Vandana Shiva spoke at IONS in Petaluma, California, on September 10, 2013. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can subscribe to weekly free podcasts, and you can get an audio recording on CD. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. Get information on how to order an audio CD of Genetically Engineered Food and the Militarization of Agriculture by Vandana Shiva by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and on the internet, and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keep this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order, or go to TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.